sing and waltz, while the Jenny played the organ on the sidewalks of New York. East side, west side, all around the town, the tots sang Ring a Rosie, London bridges falling down. Boys and girls together, me and Mamie Rourke, tripped the light fantastic on the sidewalks of New York.
Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales. This is your host, John Hagedorn. I have some O. Henry short stories for you today from his collection called The Voice of the City, published in 1919. Our first story, While the Auto Waits. Promptly at the beginning of twilight came again to that quiet corner of that quiet small park the girl in gray. She sat upon a bench and read a book, for there was yet to come a half hour in which print could be accomplished. To repeat, her dress was gray, and plain enough to mask its impeccancy of style and fit. A large meshed veil imprisoned her turban hat and a face that shone through it with a calm and unconscious beauty. She had come there at the same hour on the day previous, and on the day before that, and there was one who knew it. The young man who knew it hovered near, relying upon burnt sacrifices to the great Joss Luck. His piety was rewarded, for, in turning a page, her book slipped from her fingers and bounded from the bench a full yard away. The young man pounced upon it with instant avidity, returning it to its owner with that air that seems to flourish in parks and public places. A compound of gallantry and hope, tempered with respect for the policeman on the beat. In a pleasant voice, he risked an inconsequent remark upon the weather, that introductory topic responsible for so much of the world's unhappiness, and stood poised for a moment, awaiting his fate. The girl looked him over leisurely, at his ordinary, neat dress, and his features distinguished by nothing particular in the way of expression. "You may sit down, if you like," she said, in a full, deliberate contralto. "Really, I would like to have you do so. The light is too bad for reading. I would prefer to talk." The vassal of luck slid upon the seat by her side with complacence. "Do you know," he said, speaking the formula with which park chairmen open their meetings, "that you are quite the stunningest girl I've seen in a long time? I had my eye on you yesterday. Didn't know somebody was bowled over by those pretty lamps of yours, did you, honeysuckle?" "Whoever you are," said the girl, in icy tones, "you must remember that I am a lady. I will excuse the remark you have just made because the mistake was, doubtless, not an unnatural one, in your circle. I ask you to sit down. If the invitation must constitute me your honeysuckle, consider it withdrawn." "I earnestly beg your pardon," pleaded the young man. His expression of satisfaction had changed to one of penitence and humility. "It was my fault, you know. I mean, there are girls in parks, you know. That is, of course, you don't know, but—" "Abandon the subject, if you please. Of course I know. Now, tell me about these people passing and crowding each way along these paths. Where are they going? Why do they hurry so? Are they happy?" The young man had promptly abandoned his air of coquetry. His cue was now for a waiting part. He could not guess the role he would be expected to play. "It is interesting to watch them," he replied, postulating her mood. "It is the wonderful drama of life. Some are going to supper, and some to other places. One wonders what their histories are." "I do not," said the girl. "I am not so inquisitive. I come here to sit because here, only, can I be near the great, common, throbbing heart of humanity. My part in life is cast where its beats are never felt. Can you surmise why I spoke to you, Mr.—" "Parkenstacker," supplied the young man. Then he looked eager and hopeful. "No," said the girl, holding up a slender finger and smiling slightly. "You would recognize it immediately. It is impossible to keep one's name out of print, or even one's portrait. This veil and this hat of my maid furnished me with an incognito. You should have seen the chauffeur stare at it when he thought I did not see. Candidly, there are 5 or 6 names that belong in the Holy of Holies, and mine, by the accident of birth, is one of them. I spoke to you, Mr. Stackenpot."
"Parkenstacker," corrected the young man, modestly.
"Mr. Parkenstacker, because I wanted to talk, for once, with a natural man, one unspoiled by the despicable gloss of wealth and supposed social superiority. Oh, you do not know how weary I am of it. Money, money, money. And of the men who surround me, dancing like little marionettes all cut by the same pattern. I am sick of pleasure, of jewels, of travel, of society, of luxuries of all kinds."
"I always had an idea," ventured the young man, hesitatingly, "that money must be a pretty good thing."
"A competence is to be desired, but when you have so many millions that—" She concluded the sentence with a gesture of despair. "It is the monotony of it," she continued, "that palls. Drives, dinners, theaters, balls, suppers, with the gilding of superfluous wealth over it all. Sometimes the very tinkle of the ice in my champagne glass nearly drives me mad."
Mr. Parkenstacker looked ingenuously interested.
"I have always liked," he said, "to read and hear about the ways of wealthy and fashionable folks. I suppose I am a bit of a snob, but I like to have my information accurate. Now, I had formed the opinion that champagne is cooled in the bottle, and not by placing ice in the glass." The girl gave a musical laugh of genuine amusement.
"You should know," she explained, in an indulgent tone, "that we of the non-useful class depend for our amusement upon departure from the precedent. Just now, it is a fad to put ice in champagne. The idea was originated by a visiting prince of Tartary while dining at the Waldorf. It will soon give way to some other whim. Just as at a dinner party this week on Madison Avenue, a green kid glove was laid by the plate of each guest to be put on and used while eating olives."
"I see," admitted the young man, humbly.
"These special diversions of the inner circle do not become familiar to the common public."
"Sometimes," continued the girl, acknowledging his confession of error by a slight bow, "I have thought that if I ever should love a man, it would be one of the lowly station, one who is a worker and not a drone. But, doubtless, the claims of caste and wealth will prove stronger than my inclination. Just now I am besieged by 2. One is a grand duke of a German principality. I think he has, or has had, a wife somewhere, driven mad by his intemperance and cruelty. The other is an English marquis, so cold and mercenary that I even prefer the diabolism of the duke. What is it that impels me to tell you these things, Mr. Parkenstacker?"
"Parkenstacker," breathed the young man. "Indeed, you cannot know how much I appreciate your confidences."
The girl contemplated him with the calm, impersonal regard that befitted the difference in their stations.
"What is your line of business, Mr. Parkenstacker?" she asked.
"A very humble one, but I hope to rise in the world. Were you really in earnest when you said that you could love a man of lowly position?"
"Indeed I was. But I said, might. There is the Grand Duke, and the Marquis, you know. Yes, no calling would be too humble were the man what I would wish him to be."
"I work," declared Mr. Parkenstacker, "in a restaurant." The girl shrank slightly.
"Not as a waiter," she said, a little imploringly. "Labor is noble, but personal attendance, you know, valets and—"
"I am not a waiter. I am a cashier in—"
On the street they faced that bounded the opposite side of the park was the brilliant electric sign, "Restaurant." "I'm a cashier in that restaurant you see there."
The girl consulted a tiny watch set in a bracelet of rich design upon her left wrist and rose hurriedly. She thrust her book into a glittering reticule suspended from her waist, for which, however, the book was too large. "Why are you not at work?" she asked. "I am on the night turn," said the young man. "It is yet an hour before my period begins. May I not hope to see you again?" "I do not know. Perhaps. But the whim may not seize me again. I must go quickly now. There is a dinner, and a box at the play, and, oh, the same old round. Perhaps you noticed an automobile at the upper corner of the park as you came, one with a white body." "And red running gear?" asked the young man, knitting his brows reflectively. "Yes, I always come in that. Pierre waits for me there. He supposes me to be shopping in the department store across the square. Conceive of the bondage of the life wherein we must deceive even our chauffeurs. Good night." "But it is dark now," said Mr. Parkenstacker, "and the park is full of rude men. May I escort? If you have the slightest regard for my wishes," said the girl, firmly, "you will remain at this bench for 10 minutes after I've left. I do not mean to accuse you, but you are probably aware that autos generally bear the monogram of their owner. Again, good night." Swift and stately she moved away through the dusk. The young man watched her graceful form as she reached the pavement at the park's edge and turned up along it toward the corner where stood the automobile. Then he treacherously and unhesitatingly began to dodge and skim among the park trees and shrubbery in a course parallel to her route, keeping her well in sight. When she reached the corner, she turned her head to glance at the motor car, and then passed it, continuing on across the street. Sheltered behind a convenient standing cab, the young man followed her movements closely with his eyes. Passing down the sidewalk of the street opposite the park, she entered the restaurant with the blazing sign. The place was one of those frankly glaring establishments, all white paint and glass, where one may dine cheaply and conspicuously. The girl penetrated the restaurant to some retreat at its rear, whence she quickly emerged without her hat and veil. The cashier's desk was well to the front. A red-haired girl on the stool climbed down, glancing pointedly at the clock as she did so. The girl in gray mounted in her place. The young man thrust his hands into his pockets and walked slowly back along the sidewalk. At the corner his foot struck a small, paper-covered volume lying there, sending it sliding to the edge of the turf. By its picturesque cover, he recognized it as the book the girl had been reading. He picked it up carelessly and saw that its title was New Arabian Nights, the author being of the name of Stevenson. He dropped it again upon the grass and lounged irresolute for a minute. Then he stepped into the automobile, reclined upon the cushions, and said two words to the chauffeur. "Club, Henri." We'll return with our second story right after these sponsor messages.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
"You know, it's true. We complain about rubberneckers on the highway today. Well, they were complaining about them 100 years ago on the streets of New York as well." And now, A Comedy in Rubber by O. Henry. One may hope, in spite of the metaphorist, to avoid the breath of the deadly upas tree. One may, by great good fortune, succeed in blacking the eye of the basilisk. One might even dodge the attentions of Cerberus and Argus. But no man, alive or dead, can escape the gaze of the rubberer. New York is the caoutchouc city. There are many, of course, who go their ways, making money, without turning to the right or the left. But there is a tribe abroad wonderfully composed, like the Martians, solely of eyes and means of locomotion. Those devotees of curiosity swarm, like flies, in a moment in a struggling, breathless circle about the scene of an unusual occurrence. If a workman opens a manhole, if a streetcar runs over a man from North Terrytown, if a little boy drops an egg on his way home from the grocery, if a casual house or two drops into the subway, if a lady loses a nickel through a hole in the Lionel thread, if the police drag a telephone and a racing chart forth from an Ibsen Society reading room, if Senator Depew or Mr. Chuck Connors walks out to take the air, if any of these incidents or accidents takes place, you will see the mad, irresistible rush of the rubber tribe to the spot. The importance of the event does not count. They gaze with equal interest and absorption at a chorus girl or at a man painting a liver pill sign. They will form as deep a cordon around a man with a club foot as they will around a balked automobile. They have the furor rubberendi. They are optical gluttons, feasting and fattening on the misfortunes of their fellow beings. They gloat and pore and glare and squint and stare with their fishy eyes like goggle-eyed perch at the hook baited with calamity. It would seem that Cupid would find these ocular vampires too cold game for his calorific shafts, but have we not yet to discover an immune even among the protozoa? Yes, beautiful romance descended upon two of this tribe, and love came into their hearts as they crowded about the prostrate form of a man who had been run over by a brewery wagon. William Pry was first on the spot. He was an expert at such gatherings. With an expression of intense happiness on his features, he stood over the victim of the accident, listening to his groans as if to the sweetest music. When the crowd of spectators had swelled to a closely packed circle, William saw a violent commotion in the crowd opposite him. Men were hurled aside like ninepins by the impact of some moving body that clove them like the rush of a tornado. With elbows, umbrella, hatpin, tongue, and fingernails doing their duty, Violet Seymour forced her way through the mob of onlookers to the first row. Strong men who even had been able to secure a seat on the 5:30 Harlem Express staggered back like children as she bucked center. Two large lady spectators who had seen the Duke of Roxborough married and had often blocked traffic on 23rd Street fell back into the second row with ripped shirt waist when Violet had finished with them. William Pry loved her at first sight. The ambulance removed the unconscious agent of Cupid. William and Violet remained after the crowd had dispersed. They were true rubberers. People who leave the scene of an accident with the ambulance have not genuine caoutchouc in the cosmogony of their necks. The delicate, fine flavor of the affair is to be had only in the aftertaste, in gloating over the spot, in gazing fixedly at the houses opposite, in hovering there in a dream more exquisite than the opium-eater's ecstasy. William Pry and Violet Seymour were connoisseurs in casualties. They knew how to extract full enjoyment from every incident. Presently they looked at each other. Violet had a brown birthmark on her neck as large as a silver half dollar. William fixed his eyes upon it. William Pry had inordinately bowed legs. Violet allowed her gaze to linger unswervingly upon them. Face to face they stood thus for moments, each staring at the other. Etiquette would not allow them to speak. But in the caoutchouc city, it is permitted to gaze without stint at the trees in the parks and at the physical blemishes of a fellow creature. At length, with a sigh, they parted. But Cupid had been the driver of the brewery wagon, and the wheel that broke a leg united two fond hearts. The next meeting of the hero and heroine was in front of a board fence near Broadway. The day had been a disappointing one. There had been no fights on the street. Children had kept from under the wheels of the streetcars. Cripples and fat men in negligee shirts were scarce, and nobody seemed to be inclined to slip on banana peels or fall down with heart disease. Even the sport from Kokomo, Indiana, who claims to be a cousin of ex-Mayor Lowe and scatters nickels from a cab window, had not put in his appearance. There was nothing to stare at, and William Pry had premonitions of ennui. But he saw a large crowd scrambling and pushing excitedly in front of a billboard. Sprinting for it, he knocked down an old woman and a child carrying a bottle of milk, and fought his way like a demon into the mass of spectators. Already in the inner line stood Violet Seymour, with one sleeve and two gold fillings gone, a corset steel puncture and a sprained wrist, but happy. She was looking at what there was to see. A man was painting upon the fence. "Eat bricklets. They fill your face." Violet blushed when she saw William Pry. William jabbed a lady in a black silk raglan in the ribs, kicked a boy in the shin, bit an old gentleman on the left ear, and managed to crowd nearer to Violet. They stood for an hour, looking at the man paint the letters. Then William's love could be repressed no longer. He touched her on the arm. "Come with me," he said. "I know where there is a bootblack without an Adam's apple." She looked at him shyly, yet with unmistakable love transfiguring her countenance. "And you have saved it for me?" she asked, trembling with the first dim ecstasy of a woman beloved. Together they hurried to the bootblack stand. Hour they spent there, gazing at the malformed youth. A window cleaner fell from the fifth story to the sidewalk beside them. As the ambulance came clanging up, William pressed her hand joyously. "Four ribs at least, and a compound fracture," he whispered swiftly. "You are not sorry that you met me, are you, dearest?" "Me?" said Violet, returning the pressure. "I'm not. Sure not. I could stand all day rubbering with you." The climax of the romance occurred a few days later. Perhaps the reader will remember the intense excitement into which the city was thrown when Eliza Jane, a colored woman, was served with a subpoena. The rubber tribe encamped on the spot. With his own hands, William Pry placed a board upon two beer kegs in the street opposite Eliza Jane's residence. He and Violet sat there for 3 days and nights. Then it occurred to a detective to open the door and serve the subpoena. He sent for a kinetoscope and did so. Two souls with such congenial taste could not long remain apart. As a policeman drove them away with his nightstick that evening, they plighted their troth. The seeds of love had been well sown, and had grown up, hardy and vigorous, into a, let us call it, a rubber plant. The wedding of William Pry and Violet Seymour was set for June 10th. The big church in the middle of the block was banked high with flowers. The populous tribe of rubberers the world over is rampant for weddings. They are the pessimists of the pews. They are the gyres of the groom and the banterers of the bride. They come to laugh at your marriage, and should you escape from Hymen's tower on the back of Death's pale steed, they will come to the funeral and sit in the same pew and cry over your luck. Rubber will stretch. The church was lighted. A gross green carpet lay over the asphalt to the edge of the sidewalk. Bridesmaids were patting one another's sashes awry and speaking of the bride's freckles. Coachmen tied white ribbons on their whips and bewailed the space of time between drinks. The minister was musing over his possible fee, essaying conjecture whether it would suffice to purchase a new broadcloth suit for himself and a photograph of Laura Jane Libby for his wife. Yea, Cupid was in the air. And outside the church, oh, my brothers, surged and heaved the rank and file of the tribe of rubbers. In two bodies they were, with the gross grain carpet and cops with clubs between. They crowded like cattle, they fought, they pressed and surged and swayed and trampled one another to see a bit of a girl in a white veil acquire license to go through a man's pockets while he sleeps. But the hour for the wedding came and went, and the bride and bridegroom came not. And impatience gave way to alarm, and alarm brought about search, and they were not found. And then two big policemen took a hand and dragged out of the furious mob of onlookers a crushed and trampled thing, with a wedding ring in its vest pocket, and a shredded and hysterical woman beating her way to the carpet's edge, ragged, bruised, and obstreperous. William Pry and Violet Seymour, creatures of habit, had joined in the seething game of the spectators, unable to resist the overwhelming desire to gaze upon themselves entering, as bride and bridegroom, the rose-decked church. Rubber will win every time. Thanks for joining us for these two great O. Henry stories. We always appreciate reviews, and we appreciate you sharing our show with others. Until next time, everyone, stay safe. This is your host and storyteller, John Hagedorn. This is 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales, and we'll be back soon.
Jenny played the organ on the sidewalk.